helps us play the Real Resilience Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Press Play, the podcast from Real Resilience, and this is episode number 20. It's rare you can use the term game changer in the world of reel to reel. In the genesis of the format, developments came organically, with perhaps only the discovery of AC bias to radically improve the recorded audio quality being worthy of that title. But in terms of actual machines, that title must go to a product introduced in 1968. Now, up until then, reel-to-reel recorders in the consumer market were largely single-motor, two-head designs with belts and pulleys to create the transport action, or heavy industrial-looking devices that looked like parts from war surplus battleships. In the professional sector, although the audio quality was there, with four-track heads and good tape handling, things weren't that much different on the aesthetics front. Machines the size of filing cabinets and styling to match. Plus, the cost of them simply precluded them ever reaching the hands of personal owners.
Find the Press Play podcast on SoundCloud and our YouTube channel. Just search for Real Resilience.
And then Revox introduced the A77. Three heads, three motors, styling that would not look out of place in the burgeoning hi-fi consumer's home setup, but with audio quality and tape handling that could match some professional machines, and by bridging the two sectors, create a new market for small studios and recording enthusiasts. The A77 went through four versions before being replaced by what, I would guess, in the now resurgence of the format, the most desirable of two-track reel-to-reel recorders, the B77. This episode of the Press Play podcast pays its dues to these machines when I talk all things A77 plus a bit of B77 with my guest Rob Brinkworth. And if your fix of Revox reels is not satisfied by this podcast, then please be aware of the next Real Resilience webinar on the 29th of January, as it's A and B77 base 2, when we cover buying and owning one of these machines. Tickets can be booked via eventbrite.co.uk, that's eventbrite.co.uk, and when you're on that site, search for buying and owning Revox A77 and B77 tape recorders. Buying and owning Revox A77 and B77 tape recorders. And there's more to tell you about the successor of the B77, the PR99, at the end of this podcast. Before we get into 77s, I've much to tell you about Real Resilience. There's a YouTube channel, search for Real Resilience. Our latest video, an overview of the Studer A827, is one of the videos you'll find there. And we're now on Instagram. You'll see reel-to-reel imagery of all makes and models of machines from Akai to Tascam. And much thanks must go to Elliot Woodward for advising and assisting in getting this social media site up and running for me. Elliot has just started working with me on learning to support the format we love, and he joins Jared Pizzata, who has done the same over the last few months. All power to both of you to put the effort into learning about reel-to-reel, and I feel privileged that you consider my knowledge to be worthy of your time. Hopefully, all three of us will be at the biggest event I'm planning for Real Resilience since it started. And this is a one-day, face-to-face workshop on all aspects of tape and tape recorders. And it's going to be held on Sunday, March the 20th, 2022. It will run from 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon at the Derby Conference Centre in the UK. We'll be covering tape, buying a machine, machines for your application, say from hi-fi to recording or creative use, the tape machine transport, and something you can't get on any YouTube video, hands-on training on carrying out an audio alignment on your machine. Like the webinars, tickets for this can be attained from eventbrite.co.uk, but for this, search for the Reel-to-Reel Tape Recorder Experience One-Day Workshop on their site. That's the Reel-to-Reel Tape Recorder Experience One-Day Workshop. And I hope to see you there and, of course, at the webinar. Both the workshop and the webinar links can be found on the Real Resilience website, www.realresilience.co.uk. Click on the orange latest event button on the homepage to get those details. So, much to look forward to, and I'm glad you can join me on the journey. To our main feature, the Revox A77. My guest is Rob Brinkworth.
If I just turn the noise cancelling off. Oh, that's better. Yeah, I can hear myself a bit now.
A collector based in South London and a font of knowledge about these models. His journey into reel-to-reel started not with a Revox, but a Philips EL3585.
I suppose the very first time that I was confronted with one and thought, wow, that's interesting, I was 4 years old and my elder brother was gifted one by our grandfather. He was 11 at the time, so he just passed his 11 plus, and as a prize he got this sort of sit up and beg Philips with 3-inch reels on, which my grandfather had recorded a well done message on for him, and I was transfixed by this. I had recently come to learn what screwdrivers are for and wrecked a lot of my toys, so I wasn't allowed nowhere near it. So that was worse in a way, not being allowed to play with it and being intrigued by it. Anyway, roll on a few years and the same event occurred for me. So I was gifted by said grandfather a Philips N4307, which was a little mono four-track machine, which at least took 7-inch reels, which was a step up. I used to record a lot of stuff from the radio and from vinyl, because that was all there was at the time. I guess we'd be talking about 1970, 71 maybe. But having sort of coveted my elder brother's machine for such a long time, to have one of my own, that was it. I was virtually glued to it. You couldn't get me away from it. I've still got the 3 Philips tapes that were bought for me, which my brother unearthed a big pile of tapes from his house recently, and those 3 first Philips tapes of mine are still there with, you know, heaven knows what on it. But that was a good learning curve, because it was a nice little machine, but it wasn't massively reliable. But fortunately there was a Philips service centre just a few miles away from where I live in Croydon called CES, something electronic services, but they were basically like a warehouse of Philips spare parts. So if I broke one of the plastic knobs or something, I just used to get on my push bike and ride down the Purley Way and pick up a new knob from CES and come home and put it back on again. And well, I'm getting the hang of this. I'm still 11 by this stage, so I would take it apart, put it back together again, and screws would get lost, and it got to the stage where I pick it up by the carrying handle and the chassis would kind of hang out because I'd run out of screws to put it back together again. So that was the first bit. But I was intrigued by audio in general, I think. So I kind of got interested in hi-fi, and nobody else in my family was, which was a shame when you're young and with no money. But I still kind of, you know, I used to buy Hi-Fi News and Record Review magazine, and just learn from that about all this esoteric, beautiful equipment that I would never have any chance of getting anywhere near. Tape recorders in particular were massively expensive, you know, much more expensive than a turntable, for example, in those days. When I got to 15, I went to see if I could get a Saturday job at a hi-fi shop. I wanted to work in a hi-fi shop because I thought I knew everything about hi-fi at 15 years old. Of course you do. And I went in there and all the lights were off and it was on candles because of the miners' strikes that were going on at the time. I think this would have been about 1974.
Yeah, I remember the 3-day week and sitting there with candles. Yep, definitely. Yeah, yeah, it would have been about that
day. Of course, I would pick a day when there were on candles and not electricity. So they were very polite, you know, considering there was like the manager there and I think one other member of staff, basically twiddling their thumbs because they couldn't really show anything to anybody. They definitely couldn't demonstrate anything to anybody. But they said, that's fine, you know, this strike's on. I said, oh yeah, all right, okay, yes, I forgot about that, sorry. He said, come back when the miners' strike's over and we'll see what we can do. So I think it was about 2 months later things started getting back to normal and I got back on the bus back into Croydon again. This was a little hi-fi shop in the Wickliffe Centre in Croydon. We were right next door but one to the second McDonald's in the country, if that helps anybody track down where it was exactly. Great, great shop though, great shop, independently owned and run. So basically the owner would just buy in whatever stock from whatever company pleased him at the time. So we had quite a bit of what you might consider basic stuff, Trio amplifiers and so on and so forth, right up to top end stuff. So I think we had one of the first pair of Gale GS401 loudspeakers in the country, for example. Blew me away, absolutely wonderful. KEF 104s, quad electrostatic speakers, quad amplifiers, all sorts of weird things. Like we had a reel-to-reel black and white Sony VCR, for example, which for some reason we couldn't sell to anybody because it was so expensive.
But as a teenager to sort of play around with that kind of kit must have been kind of like kid in a candy shop, really, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, you know, Bang & Olufsen, for example, and to actually have one of those in front of you, and that was great. So I quite like the electronic side of it as well. Don't really know why. I'd had no training in it particularly, but the guys in the shop always hated making up leads, custom-made leads for people, for example, so I would get stuck with that, which was so bad I can actually still visualise it now. 50-odd years later, wiring up 5-pin DINs to 4 yeah. RCAs.
Horrible connectors. Yeah.
Yeah, well, especially when you've got to try and fit two, I think there were 47-ohm resistors in there as well.
This is to drop down or drop down the level.
To drop down the levels between the two standards.
Mm.
DIM being obviously different to phono stroke RCA, whatever the technical term for that is.
I guess, obviously, in the 1970s, a lot of this was all sort of wood-panelled, side-panelled and sort of silver-front equipment. You mentioned a lot of brands, amplifiers and Bang & Olufsen and Trio and what have you. How about tape machines? Were any in existence then? Were people buying them, or was it losing share to you know, newfangled cassette decks that must have been coming in around that time?
Not at all. I think the first one that I was aware of was probably the Akai 4000 DS. We seemed to get through those at an alarming rate in terms of sales because they were pretty acceptable in terms of performance, but at the lower end of the price range. So they were popular because they sounded good enough. I'm trying not to offend any Akai owners out there. Bearing in mind the 4000 DS wasn't exactly the top of the range they ever got to.
I don't mind the 4000 for that very reason that you've just said, that they were affordable, and clearly they were built to a price by Akai, but they were still a step up from the kind of Magic Eye three-valve single motor with lots of rubber wheels and stuff machines that 1960s, the families would have used those to record sort of sing-alongs at Christmas, and grandma and grandpa sort of having a fool around. I mean, I get loads of people now saying I'd like to dub these tapes off, but it's all of those late 60s, early 70s Ferguson machines and some Grundigs and those kind of things. So they were a step up from that, weren't they?
They were. Oh, most definitely. I mean, three heads, four tracks. I mean, well, stereo for a start. let's not forget that.
And they're quite nice little machine. They're quite nice to look at in a hi-fi setup. Yeah.
They weren't unattractive at all, which is important. This is something that I felt initially Revox weren't quite there with, but we can come back to that in a moment if you like. They sold well, though. This is the thing, they sold well. I seem to remember they were about £80 or something like that. I can't really remember.
Still a lot of money, £80.
It was a lot of money then.
50 years ago.
Again, it was still, you know, a lot more than a middle of the range turntable, for example.
Mm.
We had some quite well known customers as well. Some of the guys from Status Quo, for example, lived only a couple of miles away, very near to where I lived in Purley, in fact. And they would come in sometimes, and that kind of promoted an idea in the shop's owner's mind of stocking some more high-end stuff. So we'd already started stocking TX, so we'd have 2300s and 4300s. Occasionally, if we went really mad, he'd get us a 3340 to play with or something like that, which were really nice. And then we started getting Revox A77s. And on being a Revox fan, I'm going to drop a bit of a bombshell by saying that I actually preferred the TX to look at, because what I didn't appreciate being a young spotty teenager was that what I think I realise now, if I'm correct, is that the Revox was actually probably technically a better machine. But the TX looked nicer. They had more brushed aluminium and shiny knobs and bigger meters. And that was kind of everything. It was only when you sort of put them side to side. I remember getting one of the, I think it must have been a Mark III A77, and set it up and played with it. And I thought, oh, I'm not so sure about this. It's got tiny little knobs and tiny little meters. And it just doesn't look as attractive somehow. Mm. It's not as spellbinding. But when you played it, wow. Okay, yeah. Right. I'm getting it now. What I didn't realise then was that, you know, some of the intricate stuff inside that people don't see, like the fact that all the plug-in circuit boards, you know, to help people like me 50 years later mending them, had gold-plated contacts and stuff like that to improve the reliability.
I'm going to come on to your passion for A77s, because you did send me a list of the machines you own, and it does look like a who's who of A77s through to PR99s, really, and a lovely collection. But when did you first sort of clap eyes on an A77 and say, this is where I want to go, these are the kind of machines I want to major on, either collecting or looking after? Was that in the hi-fi shop days, or was that a little bit later on?
No, that was a little bit later on, really, after a large gap where I think the phrase is life got in the way. I eventually had an opportunity to sort of rekindle some of this interest that I had as a kid. And one of those things was to perhaps see if I couldn't get myself a reel-to-reel tape deck, because it was one of those things that I'd been able to play with years earlier, decades earlier, but never had a hope in hell of actually buying one. No chance. You know, I think I worked out, bearing in mind it was only a Saturday job, I think I worked out it would have taken 2 years worth of my Saturday job money to buy a Revox A77. 2 years, you know, that, which is a long time when you're 15, 16, 17 years old.
What kind of price were they selling for then? You mentioned the little Akai 4000 was £80. So for
I think it was something like that.
Just thinking, say, with exchange rates back then for international listeners, probably around $65 or something like that. So where are you thinking?
I think
on,
it might have been even
Revox.
More dollars, actually. I've got a feeling the exchange rate was something more like $3 to a pound.
Oh, really?
Like that.
$200
Yeah, it's a lot different to what it is now.
Okay, if we just stick to pounds, what we understand, you're looking at an Akai, which is £80. So what was the A77? What was Willie Studer selling those things for?
I think the A77 was a little over $200.
Big
and I think something like a TIAC A3300 would have been maybe like 160, 170, something like that. You can quote me on those, but they might still be wrong.
No, that's fair enough. No, I just think
it was a long time ago.
That's still a big investment for, you know, you think, well, nowadays we look back and say, well, £80, $80, it's not that much. But when you think what the average sort of family income, even in the 1970s, was, that was still, then you were jumping up to £200, three times that amount. That was a real considered purchase, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Most definitely, yes. Yeah.
So you finally got your first A77. When was that? What mark was it? What condition was it in?
I'd forgotten more than I ever knew about such things. So having got an idea of, I quite fancy one of those, you know, one of those things that I could never afford. And I initially started looking for TX, because I was still thinking, well, yeah, they were quite sexy. Whereas the Revox was more, I wouldn't say industrial exactly, but
utilitarian, I think, would be the word.
It was built to do a job and not, well, it was actually the first model they made that was actually made to be pretty, but to make it so pretty would have been such a big jump from the G36 that they probably couldn't have got away with it. You know, they'd have lost a lot of market share probably from trusted owners who'd had C36s and D36s and F36s. And
the Swiss-German idea of pretty and the Japanese idea of pretty are not really related, are they?
That's right, yeah. I believe the A77 was the first machine for which they employed the services of a commercial designer to make it look nice, which they never done before. I think that's correct. And It was, I mean, it did look an awful lot better than the valve machines that preceded it. So anyway, to answer your question finally, I just started looking for tape recorders, and there was a couple of TX, and then I saw Revox. I'm like, yeah, Revox, yeah, I remember that. A77s, yeah, we used to sell them. Oh, and there's one there, look. Oh, and it's what's it up to? It's up to 70 quid. That seems a lot for a beaten up old tape recorder. It's not far away, though. Okay, and I watched it, and I watched it, and I watched it. And I, this is on eBay. I got it for, I think it was £141 eventually.
When was this?
It was a Mark IV.
So when? What year was this?
Oh, sorry, when? This would have been midway through 2017.
Wow, that's still a good price for an A77, even 5-6 years ago. Yeah.
I think it was before things had gone up massively. Anyway, I went to pick it up a day or two later, and I got it home, and I had a look at it, and I thought, well, that's interesting. It says on the front there, 7.5 and 15. That doesn't sound familiar. Okay, I'll better look into this. So then the realisation struck me that all the ones we'd ever had in the shop, Revoxes at least, were all normal speed ones. They're all 3 3/4 inches a second, or 7 and 7.5 inches a second, choice of the two. We never had a high speed one. The Tascams that we were messing about with, we used to get high speed ones of those, but obviously the high speed Revoxes were quite a bit rarer. So I thought, oh, okay. I did a bit of reading, and Google is your friend and all that. You know, found out it was a good option, a better option. So I thought, ah, excellent, that's good.
Do you know the story behind why they have those? They had those little stickers for the high speed version.
Well, the second one I bought had those.
Mm.
This first one was a factory machine, so it didn't have little stickers. You tell me your story, and I'll tell you my version if you like.
Well, I heard that Revox had big ideas for the A77. It was going to be, you know, going to go into professional or semi-professional environments and consumer, which they were selling like the G36 into. And so they basically had the front panels silk screened and made up in their thousands. And then they thought, well, we've got the 7.5 IPS, 3 3/4, 7.5 IPS version, normal speed run, selling well. Let's make the high speed version. And then they realised that it would cost them a bit more to get the silk screen. So they issued the little stickers to go over the front panels. That's what I heard.
Ah, okay. I've got a. That may well be true. And it does make a lot of sense. The story I heard about it was that the importers in various different countries had a demand for high speed machines, but they couldn't satisfy the demand from the factory. I think the factory was so busy churning out normal speed ones, they only had one production line, so they'd switch for a few days from normal speed ones to high speed ones, and then back again. So what the importer, which I think was Bausch in the UK at the time, the factory would send them the replacement cards that they would need and a motor to convert normal speed ones to high speed ones. And I've got an FWO Bausch price list somewhere that says, now I'm talking in really round numbers here because I can't remember the specific numbers, but it was something like you could get a normal speed one and it was, let's say it was £200, or you could get a high speed one and it was £250, or you could get a converted one by FWO Bausch using factory components, and it was those figures I just gave you can't be right, of course, because I remember the differential between getting a factory high speed one and one done by the importer was £50. You could save 50 quid by getting it converted, and that kit included the two little stick-on stickers for the front panel.
Well, possibly. I mean, the A77's got a lot of history behind it. It's been going, what, since 68, something like that. So, yeah, there must be a few myths and stories grown up. I know the stickers varied, didn't they? Because on the continent, they were in centimetres per second, but UK and, US ones would have been in inches per second. Certainly all the ones I've ever seen have been 7.5 and 15 IPS as opposed to 19 and 38 centimetres per second.
Yeah, the second A77 I got was a one with the stickers on. As you say, the continental ones had big stickers on the front, which were as near as they could get to the colour of the front panel. But they had the new speeds on, plus the sticker went down a bit further and said something like A77 Professional or something. Whereas the ones that, if my story is the right one, the ones with the tiny little 7mm or so little stickers that just went over the numbers for the speed, that just said 7.5, they were circular, circular little stickers. And the second A77 I bought was equipped with those.
So you say second machine, because you've got quite a collection now, and you sent me a list, but the first one on this list is something I'd like to talk about. It's a Mark I, but tell me a little bit more about it.
Ah, yeah. That was another eBay find. To start with, I'd only really looked at Mark III's and Mark IV's because they looked... I felt that the silver front on the control panel on the Mark I's and Mark II's weren't quite as much to my liking. But, I don't know, I started thinking, maybe they're good. And I looked at a Mark I, and fortunately, in the series of photographs for it, was a photograph of the sticker by the voltage selector that shows the serial number. And I thought, there's an awful lot of zeros in that serial number. So I had a look at my book. I think I'd bought Mr. Ogliati's book by this stage to help me out. And in there it said that anything over serial number S100 was a production machine, and anything prior to that was a pre-production machine. And I know Luca himself has got one of the pre-production machines that has been signed up by, oh, his name eludes me, the guy that designed the electronics. It's, all the internal panels are signed by him. But that's a pre-production one. But this was S000119, and I thought, well, if the production one started at 100, that makes that number 20. So I contacted Luca. I got another friend of mine that lives nearby, actually. He's got quite a few Mark ones, and he said, I've got a really, really early one. I've got a 1967 one. It's really, really early. And I said, oh, okay, what's the serial number? And he said, oh, it's 3000 and something. So I said, well, mine's 119. And he said, oh, yeah, right, okay, that's way earlier than anything I've got. And I spoke to Luca, and he said, well, from what I can glean from the extrapolating the factory records, it looks like that was probably made on the very first day of the 11 years of production.
Wow. It's got the S at the start, hasn't it? Because that denoted it was made in Switzerland, because models with G were made in Germany, weren't they?
That's right, yes, yeah. They were. Towards the end, they were all made in Germany because the Swiss line had to be cleared for manufacturing the A700 when that came out.
Do you have any particular affinity for whether they were made in Switzerland or Germany? I just wonder whether you feel that if it's a Revox, it's got to be made in Switzerland, or are you happy that it was made in their satellite factory?
For all practical purposes, I don't feel that at all, no. I feel that my experience of the Swiss-made ones and the German-made ones is that they are exactly the same quality. I can't discern any difference in build quality between the two at all. You could, if I had a German one with a G prefix, so made in Lofingen, is it? It kind of gives you a nice warm feeling when you see the S at the front of the serial number, but I've taken quite a lot of these apart and put them back together now, and I really cannot tell the difference between the Swiss-made ones and the German-made ones. It's almost as if the circuit boards and the motors and everything in it were actually made in the same place, and all the parts were just assembled in a different factory. So for example, Studer had a... I was looking yesterday at an old photograph of their motor building room, where there were all these ladies. Like a lot of car manufacturers of the same period, they used ladies because they had slimmer fingers and were more dexterous than men to actually do the windings for the motors. And you could see all these motors lined up on racks attached to reels of copper coming in to, you know, make the windings. I suspect they made them all in one place and then picked a load of them up, stuck them on a van and shipped them over to Germany, where they would be put on it was an assembly line rather than a full production line in Germany. I think a lot of the stuff was probably still made in Switzerland.
Of course, the other thing we have to take into account, these machines, the youngest of them is, what, getting on for 45, 50 years old now. they've all had a history. I mean, I've had machines, it looks like a Mark One, and it's got it bits, clearly bits inside from Mark Threes, and, you know, different boards people have added to them. The other thing, of course, is with the motors. You mentioned those. Yes, they did make their own, but of course, Revox or Studer were then, I think, towards the end of production, using Pabst motors and buying them in, certainly on their bigger machines, their big 24 tracks and latterly the A22 tracks. They're all Pabst motors. And I have actually found some A77s that have got Pabst on the bell housings, and they look like Revox motors, you know, that you can tell they're the slightly later ones because they've got the three holes drilled in the base for further cooling and the bell housing. But yeah, they've got Pabst around them as opposed to Revox. And that surprised me because I thought, you know, Revox always wound their own motors up until about, I think it was about 88, 89. These machines clearly date from the 1970s, and they've got Pabst all over them. So they must have bought some their items in, maybe just to keep up with demand. They subcontracted certain parts of it to Pabst.
Well, I think originally, now I do stand to be corrected on this. You know, I'd like to think I'm right on everything, but I'm sure I won't be. But my understanding is that they were all Pabst motors to start with, and at some stage, I think, and I think Studer brought them in for the early, certainly as you say, the early Revox A77s all had Pabst written on them, but they're clearly the same. I'm speaking of the real motors now rather than the Capstan motor, but they all have Pabst written on them, which is fine. And as you say, later on, you know, if you look inside a Mark III or a Mark IV, it'll say Studer Revox. But it's, I think what may have happened is that Studer either possibly bought out Pabst, I am guessing here, or bought the rights to remanufacture Pabst design motors themselves. But it seems to be the old ones that are labelled Pabst and the later ones say Studer Revox.
That's it. I've just opened up these machines and found sort of various motors. But of course, there's no guarantee that machine, with the age it is, was actually made with those motors. They could have been changed out in their lifetime. You can always tell, you know, these machines have had the covers taken off them numerous times. The screws are missing, or, you know, all the little holes are punched through on the trim pots on because people have just stuck the trimmer tool through. You've got your Mark One, dates from day one. That's a great find on eBay. You've also got examples, Mark Two, Three, and Four machines. You've got a Dolby version as well. What's your thoughts on the Dolby version? And indeed, if you could shed some light on it, were the Dolby units only on the Mark Four, or were they found on other marks of machine?
Yeah, I've got a Mark II as well. I did a Mark II for a customer, a high-speed one. The high-speed ones only came in towards the end of Mark I production, and but throughout Mark II, III and IV production, you could get high-speed ones or normal-speed ones, or indeed, if you wanted to, low-speed ones or super-low-speed ones. Yeah, so I got a Mark II mainly because it looked like it needed saving and it wasn't far away and it wasn't that much money. The Mark IIIs were the ones where Dolby became available, Dolby B. I have heard a tale that Willy Studer wanted nothing to do with Dolby at all. It was more electronics in the way of his signal and he didn't want it. So much like a lot to do with Revoxes, you were basically given what you needed, and if you didn't need it, you can't have it, pretty much. And until I think it got to the stage where the marketing department said, look, TX doing it, Akai's doing it, Sony's doing it, we're going to lose market share if we don't offer a Dolby version. So he said, okay, but only the normal speed ones. I'm not having a high speed Dolby. So, and that only happened with the Mark III. So I think it was available. It was possible to fit it before that. But Willy Studer's view was, look, if you want something with half as much noise, buy a high-speed one.
Yeah, he's got a point there. I mean, of course, those two Dolby cards went in place of the power amp cards, if you had the internal power amps, because you always had, on every machine, you had the speakers on and off button, didn't you? Bottom left-hand side.
They always had the speakers.
Yeah, even if they didn't have the amp cards in. But those Dolby boards, I always feel, are they're of their time, because you look at Japanese Dolby circuitry, and it's usually just two or three ICs, but this thing is just transistors upon resistors upon capacitors, just bristling over one board that's the size of the power amp board, and that's just one channel, and you've got another one as well. And they were really making poor headway in trying to create Dolby, and if you ask me, a bit ham-fisted way of putting Dolby on a machine, whereas Japanese were just getting chips and sticking them on nice circuit boards.
Yeah, I think the chips came a bit later when Dolby B kind of took off. Dolby Labs in Streatham would only allow stuff to be made under license, basically initially based on discrete components, and it was only when the concept of it really took off that the massively expensive process of getting them miniaturized onto integrated circuits became a practical option. And I think the A77 missed that boat slightly, so it was still discrete components only. And as you say, quite chunky. Every A77 has got loudspeaker sockets on the back of it, and it's got wiring from the loudspeaker sockets down to the power amplifier boards. But obviously, if you've got no power amplifiers, they don't work, and the speaker off button doesn't do anything. But as you say, I've got a couple that have got power amplifier boards for the loudspeakers, either external or internal, if you buy the suitcase version that's got the built-in speakers on the sides.
Of course, that was sort of Revox catering for all markets, really, wasn't it? That those suitcase with speakers was the almost back to the days of, we alluded to earlier, the sort of magic eye little single machines for the family, really, aimed at simple, keeping it simple, plugging the microphones in the front of the panel, setting it into record, hear the output on your suitcase speakers, and that was it, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And the ones with the built-in speakers were very popular with, not to offend anybody, but kind of low-budget on-site recording outfits, because without messing around with loads of headphones and leads and wires and stuff like that, if you had like a simple two-mic setup to record a choir or something, my second machine was initially owned by a guy who did exactly that. He used to go into churches to record their choirs and so on and so forth, quite, you know, big, sometimes cathedrals. And it was just a simple two-mic setup. And the one with the built-in loudspeakers was quite handy because you could really fast just stop it, rewind it a bit, play it. Yeah, sounds okay. Let's carry on and not have to mess around plugging in headphones and all sorts of stuff like that. So they did have their place. But as you said, you can't have the loudspeaker amplifiers, the power amplifiers, and the Dolby cards because they take up the same real estate inside the machine. Because obviously the A77 was never designed to have Dolby initially, so they never made room for it in the first place, which is one of the reasons it's one of the physically smaller machines out there on the market. You know, you stick an A77 next to a TAC 3300 and it seems tiny by comparison. I mean, it's quite a lump to pick up. It's a big old beast with, you know, three hefty motors in it and so on, but physically, external dimensions relative to a lot of other decks, going right back to that Akai 4000DS, is probably a similarly sized machine, I would think. Yeah, and then of course the B77 came out, which was a bit bigger, and then the A700, which was bigger again, because that's based on a Studer B67, and so on and so on.
But of course, that Dolby was never carried through to the successor of the A77, the B77.
Yes, it was carried through.
Oh, it was? Oh, right. Ah. I stand corrected.
You won't find many of those about, though. They only made about 200 of them right towards the very end of production when they were shutting down. So this would have been around, I think, 1979 or 1980. They made around 200 Dolby B77s.
What tape speed were they?
That's a very good question, because I don't own one and I've never actually seen one in the flesh. And I'm trying to remember. If Willie Studer had anything to do with it, there'd have been normal speed ones only, but I don't know for a fact.
I gave in on the A77, but yeah, not putting it on the high-speed B77. Yeah, I'm the boss. my gaffe, my rules, yeah.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. Although I had an email this morning from a customer. I think I mentioned in my little highlights thing that I sent you about another rock star. Got an email from the guy who bought it off the rock star, who's a friend of his.
Can you divulge the name of the rock star, or would you prefer to keep that private?
Yes, I suppose I could. He's Bill Bruford.
Oh.
Very, very nice guy. What a nice guy. And he came round my house. I only knew because he sent me an email out of the blue saying, "Hi, Rob. Finally had a chance to compare the A77 with a B77 Mark 1 15 inch per second. You'll be pleased to know that your serviced A77 sounded better. Well done. The B77 has now been sold on."
That's really nice. That is nice. When you get unsolicited commendations like that, and I get them from some of my customers, you think it's well worth it. It really is.
It does. Yeah. It makes you smile and think, I've done a good job there.
I'll echo that closing comment from Rob about how nice it is to receive praise for your work. It truly is nice to be appreciated by discerning owners. Rob and I spoke further about the PR99 and touched on other Studer Revox machines in his collection too, but I'm going to leave that till a later Press Play episode. I'm also going to tie it in with a webinar too, which will cover all three marks of the PR99 plus the ASC variants too. So more to look forward to if you already own or aspire to owning a PR99. In supporting A77s and B77s, and indeed PR99s, I now sell a variety of accessories for them in the Real Resilience shop. I sell the 2-pin mains leads for the A77 and B77. They are 1.5 metres long and wired to a UK standard 3-pin mains plug. Apologies if these won't fit the mains leads in your part of the world, but at a push, you could cut this off and wire the appropriate plug on in its place. The shop also sells the correct capstan lubrication oil for all Studer Revox machines, which is either PDP65 or GLY2100, depending on the year of manufacture of your machine. Download the Studer Technical Protocol 174 from the free download section of the Real Resilience website to check this. The oil comes in 10 milliliter dropper bottles, and if you follow Studer's guidelines for lubrication periods, it should last you quite a time. And I've also found these high quality synthetic oils to be applicable for the bearings on other machines too. So even if you don't own a Studer or a Revox, I've used it on TIAC and Tascam flywheel bearings, for instance, with no issues at all. Please take a look at the Real Resilience shop on the Real Resilience website, because there are other accessories as well, including leads. And if you are a Euro 4000 report owner, you'll find a whole range of NOS and used spare parts on that site too.
Find Real Resilience on the web at realresilience.co.uk and on our Facebook page, Real Resilience.
That's it for this episode of the Press Play podcast, and I thank you for your support. Don't forget the Real Resilience social media presence on Facebook, YouTube and Instagram. And if you could do me a favour and press all the like buttons on those sites, it all helps. And don't forget the events either. The webinar on the 29th of January and the big one, the one-day live attendance workshop on March the 20th this year. Both events can be found on eventbrite.co.uk. Search for Buying and Owning Revox A77 and B77 Tape Recorders and the Reel-to-Reel Tape Recorder Experience. Or go to the homepage on the Real Resilience website, www.realresilience.co.uk, and click on the orange event tab on the homepage. That's it for Press Play episode 20. I thank you for your time in listening to this podcast from Real Resilience, the Open Reel Experience Specialists.